You are listening to Community Radio KGNU, and it's time for our monthly radio book club. I'm Maeve Conran, the news director here at KGNU. As always, my co-host is Arsen Kashkashian, head buyer at the Boulder Bookstore. And this time, Arsen, it's a real page turner you have selected, and very much of a local theme as well.
Yeah, we're reading The Gifted School by Bruce Holsinger. And it's a great book. It's set in Boulder, and it's all about these really four friends and their families, about what happens to them and their relationships when a gifted school is about to open in their town. And it reveals all sorts of fissures in their relationships.
Well, it is called The Gifted School. Now, it is set in Boulder, which is obvious to anyone reading it, except in the book, it's called Crystal. And so we have Bruce Holsinger joining us in the studio. Why did you not just come out and say it's Boulder, Colorado? Because anybody reading this book knows exactly where it is.
Yeah, well, I am a big stickler for research and getting the details right. And one of the reasons I didn't just set it in Boulder is I wanted... A lot of the book is satire, you know. It's written as a kind of dark contemporary satire, and I wanted it to have a little bit more of a spritz. I wanted Boulder to be Boulder times 10 in this novel, or at least times 2. Hence the imaginary setting. I also wanted to play around with some of the details. I wanted the city geography to be a little bit different. I wanted the surrounding topography and demographics to be something I could manipulate just a little bit. And so writing, I have written a fair amount of historical fiction. Coming from there to contemporary fiction, I wanted to have the same, I wanted to do the research I needed to do, but also to have the kind of poetic license, the same poetic license you get when you're imagining a past scenario.
Well, you say in the book that you conceived of this idea several years ago when you were actually living in Boulder.
More than several years ago, 15, more like 15 right? years ago.
Well, it's so contemporary. The themes in the book around privilege, around class privilege, race privilege, and also the recent school admissions cheating scandal, all really loom large at the background of this. And yet 15 years ago, these things weren't necessarily happening. Well, the privilege aspect, I'm sure, was, but not to the degree that we're having these conversations about.
Sure. Not the same degree about, you know, the admission scandal, which is a whole other aspect of how this book has been received so far. But certainly competitive, the culture of competitive parenting. I think that's kind of a given. That probably goes all the way back to, you know, the ancient world to some degree. But is in a place in a pressure cooker like my town, Crystal, the reimagined Boulder, you know, people call it the Berkeley of the Rockies, the Palo Alto of the Rockies. It's a pressure cooker town where the name of the game is, you know, accruing as much advantage as you can for your kid. And so that's one of the themes I wanted to explore in this novel, is that that investment in what the parents want for their kids, not necessarily what the kids want.
So when you conceived of 15 years ago, was there an incident in your own life, or was there events that were driving it, or is it just your observations? Was there something that brought this to the front of your mind? Because it's a little different than what you've done in the past in your career and in your literature.
Yeah, I suppose it was, you know, Boulder is where both of our sons were born, and we moved away from here before they were really in elementary school. I think our older son was 5 when we moved away. But there was something even in the primary years about, you know, milestones, about whose kid is saying how many words. Oh, Susie is a wonderful reader. She just reads all the time. Do your children read? That kind of language. And it wasn't anything, there's no specific kind of, attachment to any given individual in here, or, you know, there's no person I'm representing that I remember. But just the ethos of gifty parenting. And that I think that's really what I'm trying to hit on. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and also to me, I read it as get back to the earlier question, is Crystal instead of Boulder, because while there are great similarities to Boulder in the town, this is something you see everywhere, whether you're in Virginia now or Connecticut.
Yes, exactly.
Or I felt some of the people were a little more East Coast driven. Mm-hmm. Then I kind of see here. So I felt like it was an amalgam of different things going on that you were able to explore these themes.
Well, yeah, and that's another element of that went into the decision not to set it in actual Boulder, but to imagine a slightly different kind of place that's maybe more. I mean, Boulder, just from the way I remember it, you know, there is that, you know, that old keep Boulder weird ethos. And, you know, there's still just enough kind of relaxed Birkenstock wearing folks around here that maybe it wouldn't have worked. But I, you know, this really is a kind of a universal story of privileged pressure cooker America. So I think that maybe gave me a little bit of a license to play around with the setting in the ways that I did.
So you center the book on four female friends, mm-hmm. and they meet when the babies are infants. So all their kids are 10,
yeah.
or coming out of fifth grade, and you follow them. But could you tell us about these four friends and you know, some of their characteristics?
Yeah. So there are four of them. One, the main protagonist of the novel is Rose, and she is a pediatric neurologist, and her life's work, her work when she goes into the lab, she works at a hospital, is also a doctor. She thinks about kids' brains, and she is very interested in the neurological health of children and brain development. She's also, of course, very interested in the brain of her daughter, Emma. And so I wanted to have her in a very high-powered intellectual profession where that would kind of wed her day job and her night job, you know, thinking about her daughter. And then she has three friends. One is Azra, who is a native Crystallite, rather, and she is the owner of a used clothes store downtown. She's kind of a recovering hippie. She has two boys, twins, who are great soccer players. They play travel soccer. And her ex-husband, Beck, their father, is also one of the viewpoint characters. We could talk about him as well. Another one of the friends is Lauren, who is a widowed social worker, a deep social conscience about issues of equity and inclusion in primary education, but is also very much looking out for her gifted son, Xander. She also has a gifted daughter, a teenager who's quite troubled, who's out of rehab. And then finally, there is Samantha, who is the queen bee, Samantha Zeller. She's a sometime fitness instructor at the rec center where they all meet. She's also the mother of an Emma, Emma Z, Emma Zeller. And they're very wealthy. They live on what I call Maple Hill, imagining Mapleton Hill in Boulder. And she's a kind of, in some ways, the anchor of the group. She's the one who gets them going and really gets the engine of this friend group going in the first place. So those are the four women at the center of this knot of friendship.
There is another family that's not part of the core group, but is certainly connected to it. And this really highlights the chasm between the very privileged and then the people who work in the service industry for those privileged. And this is a family of Peruvian immigrants.
Peruvian migrant workers.
Workers. And they live in, is it Beulah County?
Beulah County. Yeah, again, just made up county.
But this is to the east. But they're kind of brought in as well. And really that kind of juxtaposition of enormous privilege and the people who are really invisible to them, who make, you know, the privileged people's lives move a little bit easier.
Yeah, and that issue of visibility and invisibility, that's the main reason I wanted to make, rather than just have them represented, I wanted one member of that family, just like the other families, to be a viewpoint character whose perspective I would try to explore. And that is Shania, who is the grandmother of this brilliant trilingual kid named Atik, who speaks his heritage language of Quechua fluently, and he speaks Spanish fluently like his mother does, and now he speaks English fluently. And so he's also kind of an origami artist, a kind of brilliant kid with spatial relations. And of course, the school districts have their eye on him, right? And the administrators, who are very interested in equity inclusion, rightly so, see Atik as a kind of gold mine for working out these issues. But at the same time, I really wanted that family to be kind of working alongside the others in the narrative to kind of expose the issues of privilege and inequity and so on.
And the grandmother is very interesting because she's pretty wise to the ways, certainly of the school district and these folks who are like, oh, we want to include you, seeing them as, you know, tokenizing maybe her grandson,
exactly.
Or I'm going to, you know, fulfill some sort of quota that you might have, and really taking a I don't want to say cynical, but much more nuanced look that, you know, I was glad you flushed out her perspective on
good,
that.
Oh, good, good, good. Yeah, she's very suspicious. You know, she's casting a suspicious eye over what this school system is doing, its designs on her son. She's also a little suspicious, or her grandson, rather. She's also pretty suspicious of her daughter's boyfriend, who's bringing computers into the house, who's maybe giving her grandson Atik these grand ideas about, you know, what he could do with his life. So one of my aims in the novel was to really create a multi-generational tale that would have, you know, children as young as 10 rising sixth graders, would have a teenager, would have a couple of parents, and in her case a grandmother. So it's about age, but it's also about socioeconomic difference and so on.
It's interesting because very often this narrative around migrant families is that they see education as the way to really move on to the next tier of American society, where the grandmother in this case, you know, she doesn't embrace that at all because she's quite suspicious of how all of this is playing out.
Yeah, she, what's wrong with doing what we do? You know, it's I really was working very hard to avoid those kinds of stereotypes, and you know, and when you're writing across differences of race and so on, you're always going to bungle, you're always going to make mistakes. I'm sure there are things in here that I got wrong, but I did have a few readers from that kind of community read it, and you know, it was that kind of, I put as much research into that as I did into Rose's career in pediatric neurology.
So the novel starts with these four friends and this other family, and it starts on what I would call very realistic footing. And then the gifted school, the school is going to open, and they're going to admit 1,000 students in a area that has 100,000 students. So the 1%. And then as the book moves on, you slowly move towards satire. Can you can you talk about that difference between a realistic book and a satire? And did you always feel you're going to do that, or do you have to strike a balance? How far can I go?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it. No one's described it to me that way, as a book that changes from realism to satire. I had thought I'd sort of a gently satirical, realistic edge all the way through. But, you know, even in those early scenes with Beck, you know, standing with his foot on his bumper with a Feel the Burn bumper sticker on his Audi, right? I wanted even from the beginning to have those details where I was sending these folks up a little bit. But yeah, so as you go along, you know, the grenade has gone off. And what happens after the grenade goes off? You know, people get hurt, and the situation gets very extreme. So the gifted school, you know, lands like a bomb in the middle of this group of friends, and it's what starts setting them against each other. What puts marriages on edge, gets friends going against each other, and so I guess the satirical elements. I'll have to think more about that, about whether I was aware as the novel goes along of that becoming sharper.
Did you ever have to pull back? Did you ever have something written and say, that's a little too far?
Yes. And my editor helped me see that. Mm-hmm. This novel, you know, like any novel, it went through a lot of revision. And, my agent, my editor, a few other readers were, you know, very, you know, oh, people just aren't going to believe that. Of course, then the admissions scandal happened, and I worry that's blunted any satirical edge the novel might have, because now we know that parents will literally do anything. They'll commit felonies to get their kids into the right school. So that, you know, it's gone from, you know, over the edge satire to, you know, who wouldn't fake an IQ test?
Right. So one thing I thought was interesting, and maybe you could read a passage about this, is the parents, when the gifted school is announced, kind of really go all in. They start losing their moorings a little bit. And but what becomes interesting is when Rose finds out that it's seeping down to the 10-year-olds now, that it's changing who they are. And maybe you could read a little passage as Rose is driving with the two Emmas.
Yeah, so she's driving them to their horseback riding lessons. They've taken them together for a long time. And so they're in the back of the car, and they've just had this nasty conversation about their classmates. For Rose, the last 5 minutes of the drive passed in a trance-like state of despair, her ears gathering more of their hateful chatter as they went along. They had moved on from the subject of the academy and were now cycling through the other girls in their riding class, sorting the decent riders from the poor, the skillful from the pathetic, another lovely new word. There had been some small behavioral issues with Emma Q over the last year, all of them at school. A call from the principal about passing notes. A half dozen girls rebelling against the gym teacher for making them run laps in the drizzle. Minor stuff. This was different. The Emmas had suddenly metamorphosed into mean girls. Little bullies, pre-adolescent vipers ruthlessly judging those deemed inferior. More than that, Emma Q sounded like a different person when she was talking to Z, withering, ungenerous, casually cruel, like someone else's child. By the time they arrived at the barn, Rose's skin was sheathed in a cold, almost feverish sweat. She wasn't paying attention to her speed in the unfamiliar SUV, and as she drove through the gate into the parking lot, she almost hit a signpost. The Buick skidded before coming to a stop, the wheels kicking up a haze of dust that lingered when the doors slid open and the girls tumbled out, Z on the passenger side, Q on hers. Rose climbed down from the high driver's seat. Q was already slipping on her riding shoes. Rose stood over her. "We'll talk about this later," she told her daughter. For a moment, Emma looked scared or ashamed, but then she shrugged, buckled her riding helmet, and ran off to join her friend. The Emmas skipped together to the barn.
That's author Bruce Holsinger reading from his new novel, The Gifted School. It's set in Crystal, Colorado, thinly disguised Crystal, Colorado. It's really Boulder, Colorado, as anyone reading this, and it really is satire, except it is so real in the light of the college admissions scandal as well. And how has that changed the reaction to the book? Because we have the four parents in here, yes. And it's really the mothers who are pushing at all costs, really, to get these kids into the gifted school. We're seeing this play out in real life, obviously. How has what's happened in real life actually changed the reception to your book?
Well, the early copies, the advanced reading copies of the novel were circulating, I think, starting in January, February, and then I think the admission scandal, I think that broke in March, I want to say. And suddenly I'm getting these emails like, "Hey, this is your novel." And I thought, okay, that's ridiculous, because these kids are fifth graders, and we're talking about parents trying to get their kids into Yale and so on, or USC. And but the more I thought about it, you know, the more it kind of made sense. And I think it was what some news editors got interested in, you know, a novel that kind of looked ahead, that predicted the college admission scandal even. I ended up writing a piece about that for Vanity Fair that they commissioned, and that became the kind of buzz, for what it's worth, you know, around the book, is that this is a book that is about a contemporary sensibility that's very much related to helicopter parenting, snowplow parenting, bulldozer parenting, they call it, where, you know, you're clearing out all the obstacles for your kid to succeed.
I was surprised, I think, that there was such a reaction to the college admission scandal, because in my mind, it's like people who have money and means have always done anything to let their kids advance. I think I'm surprised that maybe they're being punished in some capacity, because to me, this is just one of life's out in the open secrets that we don't necessarily talk about.
Yeah, and aside from, you know, the felony versus non-felony, what's really the difference between giving $40 million for a building in your family's name and having a much better chance of getting your kid into that school versus, you know, buying off a soccer coach for, you know, an eighth of that money, right? I mean, that the difference is, of course, one is legal and one is not. But morally, is there, well, I shouldn't say that, no, because obviously universities rely on philanthropy, but it is true that affluence, extreme affluence, opens a lot of doors in every aspect of life, and also in school admissions.
Well, in this book, the four friends have plenty of moral failures, but sometimes I would step back in my reading of this book and saying, you know, they're being exposed here. It's like the failures, the moral failures were always here, or there was the differences between a Lauren, who's a social worker, and Samantha, whose husband has you know, manages a fund and they have a personal fortune of over $10 million, there's differences between those two people that they have papered over maybe until this has happened. And if it wasn't this, maybe it would have been something else. Like, this is a catalyst, I thought, to show just how we're trying to get along in a deeply unequal society.
Yes, yes. And this, you know, these friends, and it's not just the women, the men too, they have, I think there's one point where I write that they have nothing in common except children the same age, which is true of a lot of friendships, I think. You know, when you have kids, you meet people who are maybe have different values, different backgrounds, different socioeconomic levels, because your kids might be thrown together, say in this case, in a swim class. And that was something I wanted to explore. You know, it's something that I think we all observe in friendships. Those, you know, there's issues of social stratification. There's issues of, you know, some families have wealth and others don't. Some families are, you know, there's a trust fund baby, others there's not. And I think that is, you know, that's, I wanted to have these, you know, genuinely close, loving friends, and this is the little tragedy that kind of blows them apart. But in the end, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, there is a, the novel is not just about competition. It's also about friendship and about love and an enduring love in some ways.
So you have one character, Tessa, the teenager,
yes,
Lauren's daughter, who stands a little bit outside because, in a way, she's back from rehab, and rather than the narration, the third person narration that the other characters get, that you see the story mm-hmm. through their eyes, you get Tessa's story through her vlogs, kind of first person.
Her video blogs.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you could talk about that and what does she add to the story and why did you decide to tell it the way you did?
Yeah, well, Tessa is, I originally wrote her viewpoints from just a simple third person, like I did the others. And I just started to feel like she was different, and I wanted her. I started to think of Tessa almost as a kind of Greek chorus, commenting on the hypocrisies, the failures of the other characters. And I thought, okay, she's the Greek chorus. What does that mean? What could I do with that? What kind of format could I present that in? I want a format that matches her age. You know, I think she's 16 when the novel begins, 15 or 16, yeah. And so the video blog gave me a way, and, you know, it's formatted differently in the novel. It's written almost as kind of movie script dialogue with a few small stage directions. So it makes her voice come out in a different way. The audiobook narrator for Penguin Random House, January Lavoie, did an absolutely brilliant job with Tessa. And I would definitely recommend people take a listen to that, because she did a really wonderful job with it.
One of my favorite characters was Beck. Described him earlier on. He's full on satire,
I think, right from
the beginning. He's driving the Audi. I was a bit disappointed it wasn't a Subaru, but we live with an Audi
because
he's more money. He's a trust fund guy.
Yes. And he's burning through his trust fund.
He's burning way through everything. But he's a Bernie bro. Self-described. He's got the feel the burn sticker.
Yeah.
And he's the one who's kind of outraged about all the, privilege when the gifted school opens up and... You know.
And he likes to say things like, don't call me a liberal.
Is he, you know, a consolidated version of people that you've met? Or was this just, okay, I'm going to go full on satire and come up with the broest kind of bro and put him in this book?
Right, exactly. And so, I wanted to have, the broest kind of bro, but I also wanted him to have a ridiculousness that readers would almost have a little bit of grudging affection for. And, you know, he's always screwing up. He's always bumbling. He's, you know, he's infuriating in the way that he talks about his wives and, you know, even calls his ex-wife, hey, babe, when she calls. And he's also kind of a psycho soccer dad, you know, pacing the sidelines with a vein throbbing in his forehead. So I had a lot of fun with him. I had way too much fun with him and I had to cut down a lot on his character in the end. So I'm thinking maybe a sequel just called Beck.
Beck Chronicles. Well, in terms of, you know, very contemporary news stories right now, of course, that hyper-competitive soccer dad, that was in the papers recently as well, because I think was it a baseball
match game
in Colorado and it was full on brawl amongst the parents.
Well, you know, and this is the tiny little fragment of me in this novel is the over invested soccer dad, because I am a recovering one. And I, And so some of those scenes, I've never done anything appalling, I don't think, on a sideline, but I have felt that kind of intensity, kind of anger towards a ref at a bad call, the sort of annoyance at the parents of the kids on the other team when they score a goal. And my sons are gifted soccer players, so I had fun with that and thinking about that that element of Beck's character.
But while you're being honest in that regard,
only for a few more minutes.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, from my perspective, I'm completely on the opposite side of that. I mean, I don't have my kids in team sports because I actually kind of dislike that whole culture.
Oh yeah, no, plus I do too. I intensely dislike.
Yeah,
it.
They're that's, not into it either, so that's helpful. Yeah, yeah. But are you like that, or do you think folks like Beck or these other people, it's because they're living somehow vicariously through their kids?
Oh,
is it a
absolutely.
Genuine? Okay, so there we go.
Absolutely.
Full
yeah.
on honesty.
In fact, the most mellow soccer parents I've seen are the ones who played it themselves, and they appreciate the game for what it is. They love the art of it, and they're not nearly as invested as someone like me. I was a clarinet major in college. I didn't play a sport to save my life, you know. So I have that. I'm sure I have that over-identification with, you know. Or not over identification, but a sense of you know, this is not me, so I can be all the more tense about it.
So the book is told, we've talked about this a little bit, about through various characters' eyes. And I think you do such a brilliant job. It's such a joy to read.
Oh, thank you.
As you move, rotate kind of through the characters. And you said Rose is the protagonist, and she has maybe probably close to half the novel, but not quite. And it's really balanced between so many other people. Did you, you know, Xander, one of the chess-playing 10-year-old Lauren's son, has his parts in it. Had you experimented with several different characters, or did you hit upon this mix early on, or how did that work?
It was kind of in the middle, maybe in a middle revision. It started out only in Rose's viewpoint, and then I added Xander, and then Beck came along, and then Shayna and that family. And, you know, by the end of it, I realized I wanted a viewpoint in every family.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I added last ended up being my favorite character that we haven't talked about, Emma Zeller, whose viewpoint I ended up just loving her cynical view on the other characters.
She's the queen bee.
The queen bee's daughter.
Oh, the queen bee's daughter. But she is the queen bee of her
group. Of her group, exactly. Just like her mom. Yeah, so there's a you know, there's an element there where I really wanted to get an 11-year-old girl's cynical, you know, view. A very, very social, very lovable, very socially smart girl. Especially I wanted her early on to be looking at my protagonist critically, Rose, you know. So I had a lot of fun with her point of view.
Yeah, well, I just loved all these different points of view, and I kept interrupting.
It's not for everybody, you know. Some people, you know, they want one point of view when they read.
Yeah.
And
well,
it
they're wrong
be,
when it comes to this book.
You yeah,
need
okay,
all the
good,
points
good,
of
good.
View. And I kept interrupting my wife and my daughter to read them something from one of the points of views, or this is what's going on with this point of view. And my daughter, who's 10, said,
"Oh, wow,
this is like hearing the best gossip."
Oh, that's a wonderful compliment.
Yes. It's like so much fun to hear about these people. Like,
yeah.
So.
Well, that's why it was so fun to write this novel. You know, it really, it's a sneaking into the corners of these people's houses. Right? That's really what it feels like.
It is The Gifted School by Bruce Holsinger. And we do encourage you to subscribe to the podcast of the Radio Book Club, because Bruce is going to stick around. We're going to have more conversation in After Hours at the Radio Book Club, a podcast only edition. But Bruce, thanks for being with us.
My absolute pleasure.
Well, as we always do at the end of each broadcast, we announce the next selection. What are we inviting listeners to read along with us this month?
It's a book called Full Throttle by Joe Hill. Supernatural suspense stories. Joe Hill is the son of Stephen King, and two of the 13 stories have been co-written with his father. One of the stories in the book is about to become a Netflix film.
Well, it's going to be exciting. You can hear Joe Hill talk about his collection of short stories, Full Throttle stories, on October 24th at 9 a.m. And don't forget, subscribe to the podcast of the Radio Book Club, because then you can get the After Hours edition for extra conversation with all of our authors. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. As always, my co-host is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Thanks.
Thank you.